I just wanted to welcome everyone to today's internet seminar on Food Systems 101, where we'll be learning to create healthier communities and local economies, which has been sponsored by EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. Again, my name is Jean Ballant. I work here on the Superfund side of things in the Technology Innovation in Field Services Division, and I'll be moderating today's session. The formal presentation will begin in about 2 minutes here, but while we're waiting for a few late people to join us on the phones and streaming audio, I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items. Hopefully you are all looking at the starting slide, or slide number one, for today's presentation. If you don't have that open, just a reminder that when you signed up, you were directed to the seminar-specific URL or homepage. And on that homepage, you were able to read the description of the event, take a quick look at the agenda, as well as have links to download the seminar materials in a variety of formats. I could have also clicked on the button that said go to seminar to actually look at the slides online. Just depends on your preference. Also note on that homepage, the contact information for all of our instructors as well as myself is listed, and it will continue to be listed after today's session. So if you have any following questions or comments, feel free to reach out to any of us by email based off that information. As a reminder to those of you who are joining us via the phone lines, if you are, again, if you're looking at the slides online, I'm going to ask everybody to click over to slide number two, which should be a housekeeping slide. Again, we would ask those of you on the phone lines to not put the call on hold. Just keep us on mute to minimize the background. You can use your own local mute button or simply hit star six to place your phone on mute. At the appropriate times, which have been designated in the session, if you have a question or comment and you're only participating by phone, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting pound six and verbally ask the question or make a comment to the instructor. Again, don't put us on hold. There may be background music or commercials that will disrupt their speakers. We will ask again, you just use your own mute button or hit star six to keep yourself on mute. If we're looking on slide number two, just a reminder, questions and answers will be accepted in two formats. You'll be able to ask them verbally on the phone at the designated time. I know there's some time reserved at the end, but the instructors are welcoming pertinent questions throughout their presentation if something does come up. Again, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting pound six to ask your question. Those of you who are looking at the slides online, though, you can submit a comment or question at any point in time by using one of the orange icons located above your slide. There's an orange button that looks that has a blue question mark on it. And make sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled, and you can click that button or question mark icon to have a small question mark form open up so you can submit your comments or questions to our instructors at any point in time. You don't have to wait till the end. You can do it at any time. And I will read your question on your behalf to them at the appropriate breaks in the session so they can address your question. You can also use that same icon to submit any technical problems if you're having problems with the slides or you don't know where we are or you have issues with the audio. Alternatively, if you do want to talk to one of our tech support guys to troubleshoot any issues, you can call them directly at 301-589-5318. Again, 301-589-5318. Our instructors today will be indicating as they move through the slides, so you'll be able to use the arrow buttons along the top of the slides if you're looking at them online to flip through. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backward one slide. You may also use the numbered links that appear on the left side of your screen. Those of you that have the PowerPoint open or the print copies of the slides, of course, you'll just manually flip through the materials at verbal cues. One final reminder to everybody is that today's session is going to be recorded so that it will be available for free replay and download as part of the CLUIN archive. It takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to get this session available, and at the very end of today's seminar, we'll point you to two very important links. The first link will be the seminar additional resources page where the instructors have spent a great deal of time accumulating a number of references, websites, and other resources that are related to their topics today. You'll also be able to download the PowerPoint presentations in a variety of formats there. The second link that we'll point you to as well as our feedback form. And we do ask in that you take a minute or two to fill that out. If you're looking to receive credit for today's participation, you'll want to fill out that feedback form and check the box indicating that you want a confirmation email sent to you for your records. That may help if you're trying to earn credit or CEUs. We also do read each and every single one of those comments, so I would ask that you do that, and that's how we continue to deliver such online free technical information sessions as this. I think that covers all of it. Again, the archives will be available. If you're interested, we'll provide instructions at the end on how you can access that archive in about 1 to 2 weeks. I think that's all I have for the housekeeping items. So with that, I'm going to turn everything over and direct everybody to move over to the following slide, which is slide number three. and we will formally begin today's presentation. I'm going to turn things over to Ann Carroll of EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. Ann?
Thank you so much, Jean. Can everybody hear me?
You're coming through loud and clear. Thank you.
Okay, great. So thank you, everybody. Welcome. Especially thank you to my speakers who are all national leaders in their own right and are taking their time off to help all of us here, both in the EPA and in brownfields communities across the country. And also thanks to Jean and other colleagues in the Superfund office who host the CLUIN website and are making this webinar possible. So I'll just give you a brief background on how we came to be having this webinar today, and then I'll turn it over to our experts. In the Brownfields program, I come to this topic as our scientist and our public health practitioner. So, of course, that means what are the health risks at the front end of a brownfield site, and how are we going to deal with them in the assessment and the cleanup process. But the other thing that I've really been turning my attention to is how are the ways that we can revitalize and reuse those brownfield sites to make communities healthier. And that's really where we came to the topic of urban agriculture and food systems that we're talking about today. So, you know, all of us are living in the society at large, and we've seen how as the economy has really weakened in the last couple of years, maybe it's related, maybe it's not, but certainly there's been an enormous increase in the discussion about urban ag, about community gardens, which sort of makes sense because, you know, lots of people know you can save money by growing your own food. But what was surprising as I was seeing more information about this was that there was a lot of discussion about taking over vacant lots and growing, and there wasn't a lot of discussion about testing the soil or considering the environmental contaminants, something that we work with in the Brownfields program all the time. So with that, we sort of went into overdrive and started looking at what were the kinds of things that we had found at historical garden sites and farms, and also what were the examples of projects, former brownfields that had already been turned into gardens safely, and urban farms as really examples of what would be good practices. So if you go to the next slide, slide 4, to give you the context, and thanks to the National Vacant Properties Campaign for this slide, the brownfield site, the abandoned structure is part of a continuum, a decline in a neighborhood, a decline in the housing stock and the infrastructure. And so sometimes people want to plant a garden or a farm on an abandoned lot, but frequently that's because there was a building there and that building has come down. Well, if there was a building and it was of an age to come down, chances are there was lead paint, there might have been asbestos. You don't know whether that was a residential building or an industrial building. There might be some contamination associated with all those things. Sometimes that vacant lot, it isn't really the environmental contamination you worry about, but actually the building that was demolished was put into the foundation. And so you don't actually have any plantable surface because, you know, not 2 inches below the surface, you're going to find 5 feet of building debris, rubble, maybe glass or sharps. So really it's about looking at the environmental issues of these vacant lots that are proposed for growing from the environmental contaminant side as well as the other kinds of risks. And how can brownfields resources be used to help create safe growing opportunities? So our focus has really been about reminding people to think about those risks, either because of what happened at the site before or what has happened, illegal disposal or dumping while the property has been vacant, testing the soil and what are the kind of structures to support that, thinking about clean fill, because a lot of organizations, the answer is simply to cure clean fill, build a raised bed. What a lot of people don't recognize is clean fill really means screened for aggregate. It doesn't mean it's a safe, certified soil that's appropriate for gardens. So thinking about the systems that can regulate all the inputs to safe gardening and bringing our resources to bear. And then, of course, the raised bed garden, you know, that has implications for the construction of the garden, but there's also ways you can do that that also make that raised bed more accessible to all members of the community. So slide 5 really talks about all the advantages of locally grown, sold food and urban ag. because it minimizes the cost. It also minimizes the environmental impact of transporting food from one end of the country to the other, to your plate. Obviously, it provides a use for the vacant lands, but it also actually can improve the soils, particularly where they're compacted or in poor condition. And, of course, it increases the social benefits. There's a lot of information about that, and we hope, done safely, it will minimize the environmental impacts. So on six, I just want to highlight how brownfields resources can help. Of course, communities can always approach the EPA, regional offices, or their state and request a targeted brownfield assessment. Now, those aren't handsomely funded every year. A little bit is set aside, and it's a first-come, first-served basis. But it's really directed to community organizations. All the brownfields grantees are familiar with the assessment cleanup revolving loan fund grants as well as job training grants. And I've put out just some statistics for the last year. What isn't there is area-wide planning. We've very much focused all of our sites on the property-specific kind of grant in the past, but now we're trying to look at, you know, those communities where there's multiple brownfield sites. How are there ways that we can think about this more broadly? Of course, new grant guidelines are coming online probably in August. They'll be posted on our website. And there'll be a lot of discussion about urban agriculture and food at our next National Brownfields Conference in Philadelphia, April 3rd to the 5th, 2011. If you didn't already know about this, as an existing grantee or as a potential applicant, it's helpful to know what your food environment is, and I just wanted to bring this great resource from the USDA to your attention. So you have the web link there on slide 7. And on slide 8, really, this is the way we're talking about this, both internally with the EPA and with all of you, which is what are all the different links that we can make, both with urban agriculture and food systems as part of the brownfields program. We might not always want to plant a food crop in an urban area because the site is too contaminated, or we actually want to have the, you know, suburban and urban or semi-urban farmers supported. In which case, there's a lot of other agricultural opportunities that aren't food crops, whether they're fiber or fuel, orchards, beekeeping, nurseries, you know, even talk of livestock through city chickens or goats. So there's other ways maybe that a risky site can still be an environmental benefit to the community. So without further ado, that's the brownfields context for this, but we're about thinking about how our brownfield property-specific or area-wide efforts can fit into a larger food system. Because it's great that we want to grow, but how do we find a market? How do we do those other things that are making our food system sustainable and more whole? So I have on this slide, number 9, listed our speakers. If you go to the Clouin website and you put your cursor over their name, you'll see their bio, and I can't possibly do justice to their expertise, so I encourage you to go and take a look at the level of experts we have here today with us. Kim Hodgson is going to kick us off, and I just want to leave the next slide with you, which is the reminder for the National Brownfields Conference, which is free, next year in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Anne. This is Kim Hodgson. Jean, can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. So it's such a pleasure to be here today and have the opportunity to provide you with an overview of food systems, but also an overview of food systems planning. As I mentioned, my name is Kimberly Hodgson. I work for the American Planning Association, and I manage the Planning and Community Health Research Center. Next slide, please. So APA is a professional membership and education organization representing urban, city, regional, and rural planners across the country. We have about 43,000 members, which include professional planners at the local, regional, and state level, but also business leaders, elected officials, appointed officials, educators, and researchers. And we basically advocate for good planning practice and encourage the engagement of the entire community and planning visions. Next slide. So what exactly is planning? What do planners do? Well, planners assess the present conditions and the social, economic, environmental needs of a town, city, county, or region. Planners also determine the future needs of a community, but they also facilitate a community process to establish a vision for the future of the community. But also, they plan to engage the community in a process that looks at how the community is going to grow and develop over time to meet these present and future needs. And they also consider perhaps some of the unintended consequences of local and regional decisions and how they may affect the safety of the community, but also the existing character of the community and then the social, economic, environmental aspects of the community. So the Planning and Community Health Research Center that I manage, the focus of it is really to integrate community health issues into every stage and phase of urban and regional planning practice. So then when planners are considering the present and future needs of a community, they're also considering the public health needs, but also the public health impacts of local and regional policy decisions. Next slide. So the Planning and Community Health Research Center has several priority areas, but food systems is one very important priority area. Next slide. So this is I'm now on slide 16. This is a slide that represents the food system, and I've been charged to kind of give you more of an overview of what exactly a food system is before getting into how to plan for healthy, sustainable food systems. So as we all know, air, water, and shelter are essential for life, but so is food, and sometimes food can get overlooked at the community and local and regional levels, being central to our health, but also our economy and culture. So the food system includes production, transformation, distribution, access, consumption, and disposal, and all the inputs and outputs related to the system. And what's important to know is that food systems occur at the global level, but they also occur at the national, state, regional, and community or local level, and therefore they're greatly impacted by local, regional, state, federal, and international policies and programs. Next slide. But unfortunately, our food system, from the global to the local level, are not meeting our nutrition, public health, economic, environmental, or social needs. For example, most Americans do not meet federal nutrition guidelines for fruit and vegetable consumption. 4 of the 6 leading causes of death in the United States are chronic diseases related to the food we eat, so heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and some cancers. Foodborne illnesses have been traced to the irrigation of produce fields with water contaminated by pollutants from concentrated animal feeding operations. And then on the economic side, more than half of small farms earn less than $10,000 in annual gross revenues. And then on the environmental side, more and more research is showing that agriculture is a major source of pollution of the nation's waters. And interestingly enough, food scraps, even though they account for nearly 13% of all municipal solid waste, only 2.5% of food waste is composted each year. So as you can see, there are quite a few challenges that our food system presents to us. Next slide. So what is a community-based food system? What does that look like? Well, the community-based food system approach has the potential to address all of these issues at the same time, to address the connections between the health, economic, environmental, and social needs of local and regional communities. So community-based food systems strive to be place-based, to really consider the needs of a locality, a municipality, or a region. They strive to be economically sound, but also economically productive, socially just, and food secure. Next slide. So the community food-based food systems also highlight the connections between food and other social, economic, and environmental needs of a community. So if you look at this diagram, and for those of you looking at the PowerPoint version, you're going to need to advance one more because it's until you see the green diagrams on the outside of the slide. But basically, this slide shows you that the community-based food system is not just an agriculture issue, but it's also a health issue, an economic issue, an environmental issue, a land use issue, a housing issue, a solid waste issue, a parks and open space issue, a transportation issue, an equity issue. So it really shows that the community-based food system is very connected to all the other systems at the local and regional level. Next slide, slide 20. So unfortunately, though, many people view agriculture as a rural activity and food processing as perhaps an industrial activity and food retail as an urban activity. But a community-based food system strengthens the connections between the rural and urban food system activities. I really like this diagram here because it highlights these connections. It shows that commercial farming can happen at the rural level, but also can happen at the suburban level and the urban level. Food processing, retail, and disposal at different intensities can also happen across the rural-urban spectrum. Next slide, please. So community-based food systems planning, then, is a collaborative planning process that typically includes the six steps outlined on this page. So the development of multi-stakeholder partnerships, the measurement of existing conditions or characteristics of food production, processing, distribution, access, consumption, and disposal, but also community engagement in establishing food system goals and objectives, and then the development and adoption of a plan to implement these, specific projects, programs, and policies related to those goals and objectives, and then the actual implementation of the project, programs, and policies, and then finally the evaluation of the plan and the community's progress towards achieving its goals and objectives. Next slide, please. The community-based food system is complex and crosses over a variety of issues and disciplines, and therefore the development of a health-promoting, ecologically sound, economically productive, and socially just community-based food system requires the collaboration and coordination of a variety of stakeholders. Next slide. So this diagram shows the variety of different stakeholders that need to be at the table to systematically and efficiently address all the issues the food system represents. So this includes government agencies like the planning department, health department, or economic development department, but also nonprofit organizations, cooperative extension and regional EPA offices, education organizations, school districts, businesses, farmers. As you can see, there are a lot of different stakeholders. Well, these partnerships take many forms, and the first example that I want to share with you is the King County Internal Advisory Group. So in the update of the King County, Washington's comprehensive plan, they created this internal advisory group, slide 25. So this group included representatives from every single county department or county agency, which is really unique. Not all departments are involved in comprehensive planning at the local level. And so basically, it brought together stakeholders that may have not worked together before. And because of this, because they had people from the public health department, from the planning department, from economic development department, and so on, at the table at the same time, they really realized that food was an important issue that wasn't being addressed systematically and comprehensively, and they included it in their countywide update. Next slide. Another example of a type of partnership is the Food Policy Council or Coalition. And I want to just take a minute to highlight the Cleveland-Cuyahoga County Food Policy Coalition, which includes very diverse and includes representatives from many groups and organizations, such as nine local government and county agencies, five educational institutions, numerous nonprofits, but also businesses and farmers. Next slide. Because of this multi-stakeholder coordination and collaboration, this Food Policy Coalition is doing an amazing job of systematically and comprehensively addressing a lot of the food production, processing, distribution, access, consumption, and disposal needs of the region. And this list is just a few of the topics that they are addressing. And they were formed in 2007, but have already done some quite amazing work. Next slide. The second step in the community-based food systems planning process is measuring of existing conditions. And so what this means is really identifying, collecting, and analyzing food system characteristics related to food production, processing, distribution, access, consumption, and disposal within a community. And there are quite a variety of tools out there that can be used to do this. One of them is the community food assessment, also called the community food system assessment. But then there are also land inventory tools and mapping studies that can also be used to really address the the resources in a community related to the food system, but also who the stakeholders are, what are the problems, and what are some of the existing programs and policies that may address it or may present barriers to improving the food system. So in the interest of time, I'm actually going to skip over the examples I have on Baltimore because I want to make sure I get to some of the other things I have in here. But I did want to take them out because I feel like they're really interesting examples, and so I left them in there. So please go to slide 20. Slide 33. So the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission recently conducted what they call the Greater Philadelphia Food System Study. And this is quite an innovative, interesting study because it really looks region-wide at what some of the food systems issues are. If you go to the next slide, this is an image of basically the planned study area. And they looked at 5 states, which include 70 counties, over 1,000 municipalities, over 27 million stakeholders, to really study what the, or evaluate and analyze the region's agricultural resources, so land, water, and soil, but also the production trends, the economic significance of the food economy, but also the public health and consumption patterns within the community. The next slide just gives you an overview of all the stakeholders that were at the table during this planning process. And I encourage you all to go to the link at the bottom of this page to look at that study, because after this study is, you know, is one of the first steps in their planning process, and next they're going to create a region-wide food plan to really start looking at different implementation mechanisms for addressing some of the issues. So on slide 36, so the next step, and this is an extremely important step in the community-based food systems planning process, is community engagement. And I can't stress enough how important this is to make sure that there are a variety of people at the table. As you know, as you could tell from my earlier slides, the food system is complex, and it's going to touch a lot of different people. So all these different people that are involved in food production all the way to food disposal need to be at the table. The next slide, please. So there are many ways to engage a variety of community residents in the planning process, and I wanted to highlight one in an innovative way that was used in the San Joaquin Valley in California. Next slide. So they used a tool called Photo Voice. And Photo Voice, what it is basically, is giving cameras to different people in a community and telling them to document what they like and they don't like about their community. And you can ask any sort of questions, but that's kind of the gist of it. If you advance, you'll see a picture pop up on the screen. So a nonprofit organization in the San Joaquin Valley in California gave cameras to adolescents and told them, you know, what do you really love about your community and what do you wish you could change about your community? And I chose this picture because I thought it was really powerful and speaks to some of the issues related to the food system. So this is a picture taken by Esmeralda, who's 16 years old at the time. And the caption basically speaks to some of these issues. And I'm going to read a couple quotes that she wrote. I see 2 boys in an elementary school eating unhealthy food that they just got from a liquor store across the street. You can take out the stores from my community that do not allow us to be healthy. I feel frustration because young children don't understand the consequences, and it's wrong that adults sell unhealthy foods to children. What kind of message are kids getting? Well, these images, and they probably had about 10 different images from different kids in the area, were basically used in a planning process to influence changes to some of these access to healthy food issues. Next slide. So the fourth step in the community-based food systems planning process is the development and adoption of a plan. And this really includes the development of community-based food systems goals and objectives, but also the development of action steps, policies, and other strategies that can be used to implement these goals and objectives. And more communities are realizing that food is an important issue and it needs to be addressed in these countywide, citywide, and region-wide plans. So next slide, I'm on slide 40 now. 40. So, for example, the city of Baltimore, Maryland, recently adopted a sustainability plan. And if you go to the next slide, in their green chapter, they basically stated they want to establish Baltimore as a leader in sustainable local food systems because they understand the connection between food systems and sustainability. The next slide is of the city of Richmond, and they developed one of the first standalone health elements, next slide, that includes a variety of goals with one focusing directly on access to healthy foods. Next slide. The Greater Philadelphia region, in their regional long-range plan, they recognize that there are multiple issues related to the food system that are also related to other issues like transportation, economic development, and public health, things that they already addressed, and they need to really address the food component. Next slide. The Kansas City Climate Protection Plan also states the need to promote metropolitan food production. They want to do this because they want to reduce the ecological footprint of their food supply, which is heavily reliant on fossil fuel inputs. Next slide. The City of Madison's comprehensive plan contains several goals to support community-based food systems, goals related to community gardens, to local food production, and the continued support of their food policy council. Next slide. The Marin County General Plan is one of the first comprehensive plans in the country to address food production and consumption. Next slide. Within their natural systems and agricultural element, they have a whole section devoted to agriculture and food, and this is a very, very innovative way to address these issues. Next slide. As I already mentioned, the King County, Washington Comprehensive Plan update addresses food and the food system actually throughout the plan. They really do a good job of integrating into all different existing sections of the plan. And what's really interesting is they highlight the need that food is an essential to our health and well-being just as much as air and water. Next slide. The region of Waterloo in Ontario also addresses the need to look at food systems. And finally, the City of Cleveland's sustainability plan establishes goals related to community gardens and commercial urban agriculture. I know I just flew through all of these, but I want to encourage you all to look at some of these to see how communities across the country are really integrating food systems and looking at them in different ways. Next slide, slide 52. So once the plan is adopted, the next step is implementing the plan through action steps, policies, and strategies. Next step. So there are a variety of ways that goals and objectives can be implemented, and these are just a few of them, but I wanted to touch on how they relate to the food system. So food system related projects can include things like a land inventory or a food systems mapping project, and then food systems programs can include something like consumer education related to food literacy or perhaps a farm to school program. But it can also include things like skills and business training for new urban agriculture farmers. Food system-related policies and regulations can include any number of land use, public health, economic development, solid waste, water, or school policies to improve perhaps opportunities for local food production or processing within a community, or maybe improving food production practices, or perhaps improving access to healthy, affordable foods, or improving food waste composting. Then food system public investment decisions could include the use of public funding to perhaps locate public farmers markets or composting facilities or other food infrastructure within a community. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to talk about Richmond here, but please go to slide 58. So there are a lot of ways that, you know, communities are implementing certain actions and policies. And Richmond, the one I just browsed over, they focus more on programs, but I wanted to highlight Cleveland and the Cuyahoga County area because they really focus on the role of policies to make wide-sweeping changes. So if you go to the next slide, these are just a list of some of the policies and programs that they've implemented to really support urban agriculture within their community. So they've developed an urban ag zoning district, so to permit community gardens and commercial urban agriculture within residential and non-residential zoning districts. They've developed the Farm Animals and Bees Ordinance, which permits the keeping of poultry, small farm animals, and bees in residential and non-residential zoning districts. And they've also implemented various programs to improve water access, land tenure, business training, and so on. Next slide. So the last step is really important, the evaluation of progress. So evaluating how a community is really achieving their goals and objectives outlined in the plan. So if you go to the next slide, Marin County has done a great job of establishing indicators, benchmarks, and targets related to a lot of their food system goals and objectives. And the next two slides just kind of give you an overview of the types of targets that they are establishing to see if they're really meeting their goals. If you go to slide 64, I want to conclude here. I only have like about a minute with some preliminary results from a study that I'm conducting here at the American Planning Association with funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So basically, we're in the process of identifying and evaluating municipalities across the country that are integrating food system goals, objectives, and policies, particularly the ones related to food access, within their comprehensive and sustainability plans. If you go to the next slide, this is actually a little bit discouraging. So we, according to our survey of planning directors across the country, only 27, or actually 8.5% of those surveys, included components of community-based food systems in their plan. If you go to the next slide, so basically, of those 27 communities identified in the survey, the majority addressed rural agriculture, but more surprisingly, the urban agriculture, which is really interesting, but few comprehensively addressed all aspects of the food system. So while these preliminary results show some progress in the field of community-based food systems planning, there's still, you know, great room for improvement. So it's really going to require the collaboration, coordination, and partnership of a variety of stakeholders at the local, regional, and state level to encourage lasting change. Because, you know, not planners are great facilitators, but sometimes they need that collaboration and partnership with other groups that may be aware of some of those other issues that aren't at the table yet. So the last slide of my presentation here is a variety of resources that you guys can access related to food systems planning. And I also encourage you to email me at healthycommunities@planning.org if you have any questions that don't get answered today. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Kimberly. This is Jean. I just wanted to have a reminder to everyone, if you're streaming the audio, you are welcome to submit comments or questions at any point in time by using the question mark button along your slides at the top. Be sure your pop-up blocker has been disabled. And if you want to take just a minute to see if there are any phone questions that are on the line?
Sure, that would be great.
Okay, those of you who are on the phone lines, if you've muted yourself, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute and hit pound 6 to take yourself off of mute and ask the question out loud. Don't be afraid. Go ahead and speak right up if you have a question or comment. I know there was one question. Oh, go ahead. Is there a question?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
This is Michael Goldstein in Miami with Ackerman Centerfit, also involved in a lot of brownfield redevelopment matters and policy matters down here in Florida. I was wondering whether any of the panelists on the phone have had to deal with projects where something has gone south or horribly unanticipated with respect to urban agriculture and food cultivation on brownfield sites. That's number one. Or number two, how generally you have dealt with all of the pointed questions about promoting this type of activity on impacted sites and urban impacted sites and urban impacted sites in distressed communities. That would be very helpful to some of us who are trying to get this type of initiative underway.
Thanks, Michael, this is Ann. Thanks for your question. I think we are trying to avoid those. I know there have been some communities that, did the best they could and they did what they thought was the right testing, and they didn't realize when they sent samples off to the Soil Extension Service that didn't also include an environmental panel. And so they were getting tests for pH, organic content, and NPK, but they weren't actually getting a full metal panel or other contaminants that were appropriate to the site. But luckily, we haven't heard of many of those cases, and that's why we're trying to, one, target both the TBA and then assessment and cleanup monies towards this. But, I think we probably would love to hear more about the project that you are involved in and see if there's ways we can help you.
In terms of putting together information packages or guidance documents or otherwise developing protocols or strategies for responding to either media inquiries or adverse press coverage, I'm wondering if there's been any experience yet in that regard.
Not at brownfield sites, but I mean, I think we recognize that, there's going to be some really challenging discussions that we're going to have, both about the real risk and then the perceived risk. And I think the perceived risk is almost going to be more challenging because, what we're proposing is this as a potential food product.
Right.
And so, I think we're putting together some of the kind of key points of that, but I think we have some work yet to do to bring the right people together, to have our voluntary cleanup programs with the community, talking through some of these things with health departments. If you're going to try and grow something for the market, that's different than if you're growing things for your own consumption. And so that will be another whole, thing that has to be factored in.
This is Kim. I also want to add that I think, it's very important to add the planning piece, so anticipating what some of these problems can be in the future and really thinking about the area-wide testing. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem like it's going on a lot across the country. With funding from EPA in collaboration with Ann Carroll, APA is actually developing a new report on urban agriculture, and we're doing case studies across the country and interviewing people in different places and how they're addressing a host of issues related to urban agriculture. And in my work right now related to this, it's very difficult to find examples of places that are really comprehensively doing land inventories, looking to see what are sites suitable for urban agriculture when you take into consideration all the soil contamination issues and things like that. So I would like to highlight Lawrence, Massachusetts. They've done some really great work at the community-wide level related to anticipating what some of the issues could be.
Thank you
so much. In the interest of time, I'm going to squeeze in one more question, then we'll move on to our next instructor. This question has been submitted online from Pennsylvania, and they ask specifically, the local towns in the Rust Belt of Pennsylvania, such as Beaver Falls and Aliquippa, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, that used to have many prosperous residential and commercial communities. How does one justify the cost benefit of converting the land to food production to the local politicians?
That's a great question, and it's a question of what is the highest and best use for land. And a lot of communities are struggling with this, but I find that the Cleveland example is really fascinating because the politicians there realize that there's a lot of vacant land, there's a lot of abandoned property, and how do you really reuse this for productive use? And so instead of looking at those areas as an eyesore or as a negative thing, they're really reimagining what their community could look like. And because of that, because of this new focus on really reimagining their community, they've been able to see that urban agriculture actually offers the best and highest use for some areas. So they've done a good job of figuring out and identifying and doing that land inventory of figuring out in terms of an economic perspective what are the pieces of property that perhaps have the best development potential in terms of residential commercial use, and then what are the properties that don't, and perhaps those properties, the urban ag is the best redevelopment piece. So their politicians are on board, and it's a great example of how you can really reimagine a place.
Thanks so much, Kim. Again, with the interest of time, I'm going to hold the questions right now and move us along to the next instructor, who is Ken, and we're going to be starting off on slide number 68. Just a reminder, if you've taken yourself on mute, go ahead and put yourself back on mute by hitting *6. Those of you streaming the audio, go ahead and keep those questions and comments coming in, and then at the next appropriate time, we'll start to address those, as well as have some time at the end to answer any questions you may have. Ken, are you ready to go?
I'm ready, and I want to thank for this opportunity to speak, but also Kim's wonderful introduction to the issues, and I really liked how comprehensive that was. It's going to force me to take a little bit less time on some of my slides than I planned, but I'd like today to make the case, the economic case, for doing community-based food. I think that we've gone in the last couple of years from where a lot of economic development officials have really written off food as really literally small potatoes and something that was a nice amenity but not really worth much economically. And I'm working around the country trying to show that there's really quite a strong economic potential to local food. This may address the highest use question that just came up. If you go to the next slide, I'll just show you very quickly a map of the 51 regions that I've done a local food assessment, which is really focused on the economics of food. And I found in my work around the country, this is about 10 years of work on this map, that basically those communities that do the most thorough job of looking at the economic issues in front of them are also the communities that really seem to go the furthest in making the changes that will be necessary to have a good climate for food to flourish. I'll go to the next slide just to kind of step back to a vision statement. What Kim said I think is very consistent with this, but with the Leopold Center, we really looked at Iowa State University, a vision for food economies, and we argued that a food system should really build in our community's health, wealth, connection, and capacity. Health is so important, clearly, to our nutrition. If a food system's not building wealth, especially for the people who produce food, it's not a very effective one. And food is very central to how we connect with each other. It's really the kind of main thing we do for hospitality and for connecting around our cultural identity. We also need to have skills about handling food safely. We need to be able to separate meat and vegetables at the right time and cook things in the appropriate amount of time. And in many ways, we're not as good at that as a society as we were 100 years ago. I won't have time to prove this point today, but I think my research would show that the current food system we have is really failing on all four of these counts. It's really building some bad health outcomes. Kim mentioned those. I'll say some more about that soon. It's really building wealth for some at the expense of others. It's really separating us as communities, farmers from consumers, neighbors from each other. And we're not building the capacities we need to really eat as well or as safely as we need to. So I think on all four of these reasons are reasons to really look at how to bring into a planning paradigm building a local food system to build all of those things in your community. As Kim said, it's a very central issue that connects with most every other issue. I think this is a very important way to think about how you could use the construction of a local food system to build the social capital and the technical capacity that you need in your community. If you go to the next slide, the basic economic insight I'd like to leave you with is that the current food system is very efficient at taking wealth out of our communities. It essentially does not reward producers for what they produce. It often is creating very high-value products that low-income consumers have to pay to eat, but does not really develop any wealth for those communities. And this is an uncomfortable truth. I think a lot of people would assume not to talk about this economic factor, but I would say that those communities that really recognize this are less likely to replicate the same problem as they go forward in food planning and implementing those plans.
This is just a reminder on slide number 71, for those that you are following again, slide number 71. Thank you.
Right, and I'm just going to go to 72 next. That's a good, thank you very much, Jean. I'm also really thinking for the last several years now, as we've watched the economy decline, that local foods, or what we call local foods, is probably the best path we have towards economic recovery. And I say that partly because our traditional tools, so much of our economic development discussion is focused on building housing for the tax base or building manufacturing with opportunities for the jobs it would create, and also tax base. Those tools are really not available to us now in the way they have been. They may not come back. We're really not sure they will. And what I would really say is that food is such a central part of our life. It's the number two household expense. We spend $1 trillion a year eating as consumers. That's a lot of money, and that's actually more than enough to have bailed out the financial system that we had to do a couple of years ago. It's a tremendous amount of money that we spend three times a day if we're able to. We're also really forced in food to develop soft relationships, because if someone cannot eat for a day, we can't simply say, well, they're out of the market. We have to find a way for those folks to eat well, because if they don't eat well, it's hard for them. It is a right, as has been mentioned, but also people eating badly creates health costs for the rest of us. It shows up in uninsured consumers. It shows up in medical costs that counties have to take on. There's economic reasons and social reasons to really think about focusing on local foods. When we think about the configuring economy towards the new economy based on renewable resources, based on social connectivity, based on flexible networks, I can't think of a better path than food to get us the economic structures we need to survive right now. Also, we have quite a bit of capacity. If you'll move to slide number 73, the next slide. State and local governments already spend $50 billion each year to incentivize economic development. And what I'm increasingly hearing from development staff that I speak with is that they are really frustrated often, because they will give an incentive to a factory. As long as the incentives are there, the factory stays, and often those same firms will pick up and move somewhere else when the subsidies are gone, or look for a better incentive somewhere else. Also, many of the job claims or tax-based claims don't pan out the way we're told. I think that there's a real need in the field to turn towards some different ways of investing that really will create lasting capacity. As Wayne Roberts from Toronto says, you cannot outsource a local food economy. The investments you make in doing this, in building the infrastructure for local food trade, in making it efficient for farmers to get their product to market, those create lasting cycles of connection and potential wealth that will stay. It's a very good way to spend local money that we already have in our budgets and our pockets. Redirecting that to local food systems could be a pretty potent force. And I really hope we'll increasingly see local governments devote those economic development dollars to really making food systems that hum. For the next slide, I'm going to repeat something that Kim said. I just want to really emphasize that a lot of us talk about local food in the movement, and I use that term mostly because it's sort of a familiar term that people like. But as with Kim, looking to the next slide, I really believe the goal is much more to build community-based food systems, where we actually build not only strong businesses, but also businesses that build strong communities, and that we really think about building networks of capacity that stay in community and allow us to have a much richer community life and a much more sort of solid local life than we've often had in the past. If you'll move on to the next slide, number 76, I'll give you one example of what I think a community business could look like. This is a meat processing plant about an hour south of Minneapolis. It's called Lorenz Meats. And it's in a town of 4,000 people. Mike and Lorenz and his brother bought out a family butcher shop a number of years ago, and they wanted to convert it into something that would feed two families instead of just one family. So they mortgaged the business that they just bought from their parents to build a new industrial, a new processing plant in an industrial park outside of town. They do beef and pork processing. They do most of the organic meat processing for the Organic Valley brand in the Midwest. They have their own national brands of ham and sausage and bacon that they are sort of middle price, not gourmet items that they are shipping nationally. And they also do custom work for nearby farms. They've also built thriving niche markets of up to 60 employees full-time. It's a very, I think, a very solid local business. It's really, in my mind, one of the most creative businesses in the Midwest in terms of really defining the potential for community-based food. If we go to the next slide, Mike and I did an interview a couple of years ago, and he authorized me to release these numbers, but he basically said that it costs him about 35 cents a pound to do a pound of beef, and his competition is actually able to do that processing for about 3 cents a pound at a much larger scale, much bigger quantities. Mike, of course, has a higher quality item in my estimation, but he's also doing quite a bit more to really build community as he does that work. He is able to hire 60 employees, even though his cost structure is almost 10 times that of his competition. And I think that's really a sort of instructive example that we often would say, we would assume that a cost structure like that would mean it was impossible to do business. But Mike is really proving it's definitely quite possible. If you go to the next slide, I also want to focus on the fact that Mike not only does this processing and not only does really high quality work and establish a niche market, but he's also helped launch other businesses. So he wanted to get grass-fed cattle through his shop because grass-fed cattle are considered by many people to be a healthier form of beef to eat. And they also have some water and soil improvement qualities by raising cattle on grass. He hired someone, an advisor, to help him figure out how to do that. And they concluded that the problem was there wasn't enough production to really aggregate the quantities he needed to make his shop profitable to close down his shop one day and do just grass-fed beef production. So that consultant and Mike worked together to spin off a new company called Thousand Hills Cattle Company, which is doing just that, of brokering animals from Nebraska to Michigan and bringing them into the processing plant so they can be processed at a good quantity to be efficient for the processing firm. And those two businesses now in turn are working with a new cooperative I'll mention more later. It's called Hillside Farmers Co-op. It's a Latino Anglo co-op trying to produce poultry on a small scale. Those poultry products that they are producing need to go to the same stores and restaurants as the beef that Thousand Hills carries, so they're now doing joint distribution on the same trucks to get those products to market. So I think a business with a high cost structure, finding good niche markets, spinning off other firms, building a lot of collaboration within the region, that's, in my mind, an example of a good community-based food business. It's actually a network of different businesses, not simply one business by itself. The next picture is really just a kind of break, because I'm going to, it's a nice pretty picture of corn, number 79, but we can go very quickly to slide 80, which is really a sort of very intense data slide. And I wanted to show the situation for farming in this country right now. These are the economics of farming for all farmers in the United States from 1929 to the present. And this is the kind of description I do for every locale when I do a local food assessment, but this is on a national scale. If you look at the orange line, it shows all the money farmers have earned selling all of the crops and livestock since 1929. And you see a sort of pattern of growth followed by some stagnation and leveling off in that market since about 1974. The maroon line shows how much farmers have spent to produce those products. And you see again the same pattern of growth and some leveling off. The red line subtracts those expenses from the income to look at basically the net cash flow for farmers from producing food products. I think if you look at the bumps in the chart, you'll see around 1947, you'll see that farmers made a lot of money as we were loaning money to Europe to buy food products from us as Europe was rebuilding after World War II. Those conditions no longer occur because we're no longer the dominant producer of grains in the world like we were after World War II. If you look at 1974, that bump in income happened because we were selling grain to Russia in the wake of the oil crisis that OPEC caused by restricting production and raising the price of oil to what we thought was the unimaginably high value of $40 a barrel in current dollars. Well, it's been pretty much declining since then, and these, of course, are mainstream farmers. Farmers have doubled productivity since 1969 in this country. No clear financial return for doubling productivity. With the subsidies, with the tax breaks, with the sort of support, the infrastructure we have around the commodity economy for farmers, it's not rewarding farmers very well. if you look at the black arrow on the right in the year 2008, we had a lot of people proclaiming this is the best year for farmers since 1974, and you see it was, but you also see the income was about one-third of what it was in 1974. You also, if you look at the blue arrow on the far left, you'll notice that farm income in our best year in memory was lower than in 1929. Right after 9 years of a farm depression and just as the U.S. economy was heading into depression in the 30s. If you go back to the right side of the chart, you'll see this purple line. 2008 farm income is essentially zero. I'm sorry, 2009 farm income was essentially zero. And if you go back again to the left, you'll need to notice that that's about the same level it was in 1932 in the middle of the Great Depression. If we care about eating, and this system is very highly dependent on oil being available, we're not likely to have a real strong, sustainable agriculture out of economics such as this. And you find very similar patterns in many communities that I study. Going on to the next slide, something else happened in 1973 when we started shipping, after we started shipping grain for oil, Russia very quickly got back on its own feet and stopped buying from us. So in 1974, we had piles of corn we could not sell. And we basically became very attractive for us to produce high fructose corn sweetener. And this chart would show that that became very rapidly the sweetener of choice in the United States as people realized it was a cheaper process and it was considered very desirable by food manufacturers. However, if you look at the one more slide ahead, you'll see that at the same year we'd also started noticing the number of overweight children starting to rise in this country. And there's some contest about this discussion, but many nutritionists would argue that using high fructose sweetener really is directly a cause of this overweightness because we don't have an enzyme in our system that tells us to stop eating the way we do when we're eating sugar. So I think this shows some of the complexity of the global systems we're affected by. It shows some of the reasons to be cautious in moving in with planning, moving in smaller, more local circles that allow us to have a better sense of the impact of what we do, and avoiding some of these really unforeseen consequences of a commodity system that's very well subsidized and very well structured, but really is not feeding us as well as we'd like. If you would move on to the next slide, which is now number 83, the CDC reports that we lose 5,000 people a year to food poisoning. Again, a sign of how little we have the capacity to know how to handle food safely. This is almost like having a 9/11 every year based on food that's coming from our existing systems, inspected food that's still not giving us the health outcomes we would like to have. If you go on to the next slide, the medical costs of obesity are huge, and Kim mentioned the costs of eating badly. $174 billion a year we spend on the medical costs of obesity. That's more than half of what all the farmers in the country earn selling commodities today. It's a tremendous amount of money. And it's really like a tax we pay to the medical system for the sake of having food that's really not serving our health well. If you go on to the next slide, there's just, again, just a pretty picture to take a break because I think I'm about to head now into slide 86. One of the reasons we have trouble thinking about this, and Kim has already covered this in a way I really liked, but the way I've sort of talked about it is that we talk about a value chain, or some people call this a supply chain, where producers on one end producing goods that are processed and values added to them, and the consumers on the far end collecting higher quality items at a higher price, but pays more money because of the convenience. And this is a very good model if you want to calculate how much value is added by each step of the process. But it also turns out that you see here very quickly the producer and the consumer don't talk together directly, and so they have no real way of balancing supply and demand. If you go to the next slide, the impact of that is the maroon area you see in the chart, which is called the marketing bill by the USDA. This is basically the money that the processing system takes in compared with the orange area, which shows the money farmers take in. Farmers are essentially making no more money today than they were in 1950. Back then it was 41% of retail value food. Now it's 20% of value. Most of the money goes to the middle players because they face less risk than farmers in the middle. Again, a reason to kind of localize our connections. One more slide forward. I prefer a concept I call a value network, and I think that Kim's diagrams resemble this in many real ways, where we look at sort of circular flows and also look at the connections. But between different parts of the system. Each of the arrows on this diagram on page on slide 88 would show flows of connection, capacity, in many cases financial flows that will help the community recycle resources and keep them in the area instead of essentially sending money far away. Well, then I'd like to close off, if you'd move to the next slide, number 89, just to look at some of the more happy examples that I've tripped across as I work around the country. The map on the next page shows in the blue counties, especially the dark blue counties, the places where direct food sales are rising the fastest. These are the areas where farmers and consumers are most likely to say, we want to connect, we want to know the farm where our food came from, we want to minimize the distance it travels, we want to have a sort of relationship between farmer and consumer. This is one of the rising forces of agriculture nationally, and this map shows where that's the strongest. The next slide would show a very cool example of something that makes me feel like I might be able to eat in Minnesota in the wintertime in the future. Just one slide about a greenhouse that a couple built. They're selling fresh greens only in the wintertime from November to April, only within 30 miles of their farm. They built this greenhouse with a loan from a credit union, paid it off in 6.5 years. They're now expanding into a training center, into a bigger greenhouse. We need to do many more facilities like this to extend season, especially in the northern areas, to have fresh fruits and vegetables close to where consumers are. The next slide shows an example I like because it's not only a city that Kim mentioned, but it's also a project that Liz, our next speaker, helped fund through the community food projects nationally with USDA. This is Greensboro Gardens in Philadelphia. Mary Seaton Carboy in this slide took over a brownfield site in Philadelphia a number of years ago. She and her husband had owned a restaurant in rural New Jersey, and they decided to move into the city to do something to benefit the central city of Philadelphia. They convinced the city of Philadelphia to lease them a brownfield site for $1 for 99 years. And to cap off the pollution that was below, they built the cement bunkers you can see in the lower central part of the slide. Big cement bunkers they built that they put organic soil into. You can see the plants are thriving in here in inner city Philadelphia. They also have hydroponic production on the next slide that raises the production up off the level of the ground so that it can be done cleanly and safely. The total sales from this farm, last I checked, which was about a year and a half ago, were $650,000 a year of sales off a one-acre farm. Now, they don't do that strictly on the basis of selling food, but they do sell food. They are close to about 30 restaurants in the central city of Philadelphia that buy food from them. They broker food from 75 farms in the broader region in New Jersey and Philadelphia and Pennsylvania that sell their food through the farm to local restaurants. They also sell nursery and ornamental crops that help them provide a cash flow, selling those to local residents who want to improve the landscaping of their property. A very imaginative use of a brownfield site that's produced a very interesting income in the middle of central city Philadelphia. And I think we could see much more of that happening around the country as we move forward. The next slide I'd like to show is more of a rural example. This is from the town of Viroqua. It's actually, this slide says Virginia. It's actually Viroqua, Wisconsin. I apologize for that error. This is an old factory in southwest Wisconsin that was closed down about a year ago, and the county decided to buy the factory from the manufacturer. They had to have a big struggle with the manufacturer to get them to sell it cheaply. They now own a 100,000 square foot building that's an abandoned factory, are trying to make it into a food processing center for the region. Next slide, number 94, you'll see a schematic that shows some of the possibilities here. A produce distributor that wants to expand its reach to bigger markets. And a second one that's working with Amish farmers that wants to expand their reach. Some nonprofits, a bakery, some processors, all the blue ink in this diagram, the firms that might locate in this building once it gets that settled. They've also gotten commitments from a hospital, from schools, from other places to buy food from this cooperative. Organic Valley is nearby and is playing a role to help out. Amish farmers are selling more product. The local food cooperative has 30-some farmers they've been buying from. They are bringing some of those contacts into the center. A local farm with a root cellar is saying, we can let you store some root crops in our space until you get that capacity built yourselves. And again, you see a network of connections being built by local firms, building some commerce that's dependent on each other, so that the schools become dependent on the processing center and Organic Valley becomes dependent on the hospitals buying and so on. Those local connectivities really establish the value networks I think are so valuable. And then finally, I'd like to talk about a Latino co-op that's forming here in Minnesota. This is a very clever effort to build the production of poultry at a small scale. The next slide shows a poultry barn that's made with fairly simple wood construction, covered with plastic, small chicks running around free range. They also have the option of going outdoors for a lot of their feed, as you can see on the next slide. This is a 1/4 acre production barn that's located south of Minneapolis, but could be located in a city as well. It could be located in a suburban area as well. The idea here is that the Latinos forming this cooperative hope they can raise high-quality, free-range chickens with as few chemicals as possible, organic grains, and they think that they can have about 30 or 40 of these production units that will make it efficient for them to own their own processing plant to process those chickens for a commercial market. And if you go to the next slide, number 97, that would show a schematic of what that looks like. Each of those circles with a P in it would be a poultry barn that's 1/4 acre size, and each of those farms would then use the fertility from the chicken manure to raise grains or herbs or to create compost for other farms or to raise sweet corn or apples or hazelnuts, and a common processing center that would take the chickens and get them to a commercial market. Once again, this is a sign of networking, building businesses that really work well together instead of competing with each other. This is, I think, the future of the kind of industry we need to form in the United States, and I think food is how we're going to get there. If you go to the final slide, number 98, that's has some contact information for me if you need that. But with that, I will stop talking and turn it back to Jean.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Ken. It looks like we did have a question that was submitted online, and I'm going to actually read that question now. Those of you on the phone line, so feel free to take yourselves off and get ready to ask your question as soon as we're done answering this first online question. If you have used our mute command, you'll want to hit, I believe the command is #6 to take yourself off of mute. But I'll remind you of that in just 1 second. So Ken, right now the question directed at you coming in out of New York asks, what, if anything, does greens grow in Philadelphia grow during the winter?
I'm actually not sure that they grow in the wintertime. I did not see, they do have a hoop house on the property, and they probably have the capacity to at least extend their season. I wasn't there in the wintertime, and I didn't ask that question, but I assume that they're probably mostly growing, say, from February to about November. Liz may know more about that, too.
I know they do bees, and they do biodiesel fuel and lots of other things, but I do think they rest the growing part in the wintertime.
Okay, great. Thanks. Again, anybody on the phone lines, if you are on mute, feel free to take yourself off of mute. You can hit #6 to unmute your line and ask your question.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Deirdre. I'm with EPA in San Francisco. I have a question about the cooperative that is about meat production. I know that there's a real potential for a break in the link in places local to here where localities don't want slaughterhouses to be in the area. And I'm wondering if other communities have figured out a way to sort of, you know, do a slaughterhouse operation that is as inoffensive to the rest of the community as possible, or is not seen as a NIMBY?
Well, that's a really good question, and I know that, you know, the processing plant in Cannon Falls that I mentioned at the start of my presentation really is based in an industrial park. It's outside of a small town, so it's somewhat insulated from that problem simply because it's not right in a very populated area itself. I have visited plenty of small processors that are located in small towns that are right in the population center, and they just find a way to sort of cordon that activity off so that it's not visible and it's not creating a lot of odor or difficulty. I think that some of the larger companies would have more trouble doing that, but even the large processing plants that are more highly industrialized are often located in town centers where there's an employment base, and they're able to to do that in a way that doesn't create a lot of odor. I think the biggest problem that I'm aware of is more in the kind of feedlot end where there's just sort of the outdoor conditions and the risks of disease or sort of the concentration of manure that are a little bit harder to contend with. But I think these are things that can be addressed. I know the I think this is also part of our sort of the progress we have to make as a society is to really understand that if we want to eat certain foods, we're going to have to sort of understand how they are produced and processed. And I think that it may be easier to do small and medium scale facilities that are more community friendly than some of the very, very large ones. With the chicken processing right now, they're moving to a mobile processing unit that will actually do the slaughter on the farm as a way of building up their volume. They hope to have their own plant someday. I would imagine they can do that in an area that's just outside of town enough that it will not seem offensive to people who live there.
Thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate that. In the interest of time, I'm going to have everyone move on and continue on with the presentation. So I'm going to direct all of the participants to move to slide number 99, where we're going to turn things over to our next instructor. If you've taken yourself off of mute, please hit star 6 or put yourself back on mute with your own button again. Those of you who are entering your questions in online, I do see them, and we've got some time reserved at the end to address any questions we don't hit off now. So go ahead, keep those questions coming in, and we'll do our best to answer them at the end of today's session. So with that, again, I'm going to direct everyone back to slide number 99 and let Elizabeth Tuckermanty from the National Program, who's the National Program Leader in the for Competitive Programs at the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, talk through her materials. Elizabeth, are you ready?
I am. Thank you. Thanks. I am so appreciative of being a part of this as well. I think Kim and Ken helped a great deal give you the big picture. And what I'm going to do is talk to you about what USDA is focusing on now. I'm going to talk a little bit more depth about two programs that I'm intimately involved with, grant programs, and some other funding sources that if you are working in communities, it would be good for you to know about. First of all, the new administration in the embodiment of Captain Aragon, the deputy secretary, has become keenly interested in the local food movement, both in the angles of creating better food for people, for children especially, because USDA handles all of the food stamp programs, the school nutrition programs, daycare programs, and food stamps are the largest budget item of USDA. So both from the health aspect as well as the farm promotion aspect, this is seen as a really important movement. So if we go to the next slide, I wanted to talk to you about Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, which Dr. Merrigan has promoted across the country. And it's really an effort to create new economic opportunities for local producers, as I said, also to create a national conversation, which I think probably all of you are aware that this national conversation has really taken off. The other goal is to marshal the resources of USDA, and the administration has been looking at what authorities do we have now that can be applied to local food in different ways. And also moving on now to slide 101. Looking to reinvigorate our nation's local and regional food systems and the economies, as Ken has pointed out, to support local farmers, strengthen rural communities, promote healthy eating, and also the protection of natural resources, which all come under USDA. Some of the focus that we are seeing is focusing in on food hubs, which is a lot about what Ken was talking about, and food deserts, which you probably have heard about as well, where there are communities that either perceptually or in reality have very little access to healthy food, have a lot of access to fast foods and not so much to healthy food. Farm to cafeteria has been an idea pushed for a long time in my other program, which I'll talk about in a minute, as a wonderful way to support farmers and to get good food into schools. And then also, as Ken and Kim, I think, addressed in a really interesting and complex way, food processing infrastructure in this country has really disappeared for the small farmer. So addressing that as well is an important part of this initiative. Moving on to slide 102, or I guess it's 103, I want to talk about the Community Food Project, a competitive grant program that I've been a part of for a long time. Healthy Urban Food Enterprise Development Center is a grant that came out in the 2008 Farm Bill. Hunger-free communities and school gardens are two additional funding sources that I don't know as much about. I'll talk a little bit about. Farmers markets and rural development is also funding a lot of local food things. Now I'd like to talk with you about the community food security concept. And I think the conversations about community food systems addressed a lot of this. This program, the Community Food Project Competitive Grant Program, came about in 1996, and it came from a very disparate group of people. Food bankers were realizing that no matter what they did, the food banks had to get bigger. There were more hungry people. There was more having to be collaborating with corporations that may or may not give healthy food to the food banks, but it didn't seem to be a system that was working. And so a group of people, nutritionists, geographers, urban planners, people like Ken got together and said, you know, how can we address this issue? And what happened was the Community Food Security Act was passed, and it was designed to address nutrition issues, farming and food access issues, also low-income communities issues, but addressing them in a way that would address environmental stewardship, social and economic equity at the same time. So a grant program was created, and let's see, we are up to slide 105, I believe. This is some of the detail that's probably not so important, but it was designed to fund communities that were already at work on food security. And it's designed for low-income communities. The funding ended up actually coming out of food stamp dollars, or it's now called SNAP. And it required a dollar-for-dollar match, saying that if communities were going to get this money, they had to be really into the work and match the funding so that they could sustain afterwards. And while the important aspect is to meet the food needs of low-income people and encourage self-reliance, and promote comprehensive responses. So these became little case studies of the kind of thing that Kim talked about and Ken talked about, of people trying to organize around food systems before we really had all of the things thought through about how you do the work. Over the years, it evolved that what we really needed is to address policy. So in the 2002 Farm Bill, it was emphasized that we really did want to look at policy. We wanted to look at marketing. We wanted to look at infrastructure improvement because those problems came up. We had little community gardens maybe doing farmers markets in their communities, but there were a lot of issues they couldn't address. So this sort of evolved over time. And we tried to link the projects with more than one sector. We really pushed the idea of entrepreneurial projects so that low-income communities that were involved in this work would actually become self-sufficient. I think Mary Seton Corboy in that Greens Grow in Philadelphia is an example that's way over the top. Ken, I heard that more recently the figure that was $895,000 that she has made from helping market and distribute farm goods and her own produce as well, and nursery items. And also we hope that they would link with for-profit to make the idea that this would be sustainable.
Just a real quick confirmation, you just finished up on slide 108?
Yes, and I'm moving to 109. We found that through the years, the longer the planning involved, the more multi-system interagency approaches and multi-stakeholder collaborations, the better, and that's just perfectly what was described by Kim and Ken, that there has to be a whole system that goes into this. It can't be just food production and sales. And as I mentioned, food policy councils have both bubbled up from projects, and then sometimes people have come in and gotten funded for, like, state food policy councils, and then they, from those policies, developed food projects throughout their state. Now to 110. This is the amount of money we have. It seems like a pittance when I look at all the money that you have for brownfield remediation. We have to fund nonprofit organizations, and the figures that we use are somewhere between $10,000 and $300,000 for 1 to 3 years. We instituted a planning process for now so that people can come in for $10,000 to $25,000 for planning, and that's a pretty popular process. And then implementation projects go from, well, $10,000 to $300,000. And they tend to come in between $250,000 and $300,000 for 3 years now. And, again, it requires a match. This is how we break it out. We also have 10% set aside each year for doing training and technical assistance. And the way that is manifest is we have people that have done the work out there helping others both develop their proposals and make their projects work better. And the 5%, as I mentioned, going towards planning. And moving along.
This is to slide number 112.
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry. We also have, this is roughly the number of grants we've had since 1996. We also fund, ever since 2002, a clearinghouse called the Food Security Learning Center, and that's the web address for it. Why Hunger is an organization that's existed for a long time, and they've done a lot with clearinghouses. And they have this center which houses a database that describes all of our community food projects, summarizes them, and gives you context for them. And you can search by state, you can search by the kind of project, and you can get context to talk with. One thing about this community, they are wonderful at sharing and eager to help people. Our funding is available through 2002, but we're probably safe in that we won't be sunsetted again, but our funding is renewed every 5 years. Okay, moving down to 113 now. I thought I'd just share with you some of the kinds of activities we see in our projects. And as communities are trying to do, and I always say that community food projects are all about doing community development with food as an organizing tool. Food has always been a sexy way to attract people, and growing food is intriguing to children. It brings them into sciences and it reduces crime in the neighborhood. Those are some of the things that we found out. So these are some of the kinds of things that are, and when you see these percentages, what people did for 5 years is they described what types of things they do in their projects. So it wouldn't ever reach 100%. Every project may do many of these things. But these slide 113 and 114 show the kinds of activities that go on in these projects. And also 115 and 16. So our entrepreneurial parts are probably the area we need the most work on. I think Ken would agree with me on that. We also have a number of projects in Native American communities that have worked on restoration of the traditional foods. The percentage is small because there are a small number of those projects, but they have been very successful. Our incubator, kitchen, and value added is that attempt to reestablish the infrastructure, and it's a tough thing to do. They are struggling, especially in this time of recession. And so these are some of the other things. Urban agriculture sounds like it's very low here, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily low. We don't always call it urban agriculture, but more community gardens, but that's the way it turned out in our survey. The kinds of organizations that are involved in community food projects are highlighted here. Again, I think of you out in the world working with organizations. These are the kinds of places that community food projects have either been placed or they're collaborating organizations. One characteristic of the projects are they truly are networked deeply in communities. The program is very competitive, so grantees that get funded are well-networked in communities. I think we can safely say that.
Again, this is just closing out on slide 118.
Yes, I'm sorry. Slide 119, I wanted to talk a little bit about a new funding stream, the Healthy Urban Food Enterprise Development Center. It was established in 2008, and it is a small grant, only $1 million, but they are looking at, in 120, increasing a healthy, affordable food in underserved communities, and they are going to be a technical assistance arm that collects and develops and provides technical assistance to organizations that are trying to establish healthy food enterprises. And they have the capacity to award sub-grants. So each year there'll be a competition for sub-grant awards. And so that might be, again, a source of funding for some communities that are looking for getting over some hurdle in their attempts. So they'll be carrying out, the sub-grants can carry out feasibility studies. They can assist enterprises in all of these aspects that will improve the value chain for healthy food into communities. These are the eligible entities for the sub-grants. It's pretty much everybody. And they're competed each year. I'm going to slide 123. These are, again, it's intended to benefit underserved communities. And community food projects, again, are that also. We're really looking at probably, if you think of the canary in the mine, these efforts are really trying to get to the communities most in need, the communities that showed the lack of a food system first. But also at the same time creating market opportunities for farms. Again, it's only $1 million and there'll be a lot of reporting and we hope that in future years there will be more appropriations for it. I wanted to mention also something that's provided a lot of energy in communities around farmers market. It's the Farmers Market Promotion Program. This Carmen Humphrey is the contact for that. And another program, Federal State Farmers Market Improvement Program, has existed a long time. Janice Seidmont is the contact for that. Those are good people to know. They have good resources to spread into communities. The newer in the portfolio of USDA, the Food and Nutrition Service has school garden grants, which I don't believe the NOFA has been released for yet. But there will be not a lot of money, but some money to help encourage school gardens and food systems. We're on slide 126, moving to 127. Hunger-free community grants, the RFA or the NOFA is out, and the idea is to establish hunger-free communities and learn more about the effective strategies. And that RFA is out. And on slide 128, this is the site for that RFA, if anybody out there is interested in. The deadline is September 1. So if any of your communities are interested. Rural development, as I mentioned that we were trying to see with Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, what programs within the department could be used for food systems projects. And rural development funding for rural business, loans and grants, and community facilities have been found to be really useful for like community kitchens and some sort of infrastructure development in rural areas. Doesn't help city areas, but it does help rural areas. So that's another thing I wanted you all to know about. This is my contact information. I'd be more than happy to talk with you. There are wonderful people out there. If you have ideas for projects, I can link you to people doing wonderful things. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very, very much, Elizabeth. We had a couple of questions that came in. I'm going to start with a colleague who's in the room with me right now, Mary Silver.
Yeah. Elizabeth, you're with USDA. What department are you with or unit are you with?
I am in the National Institute of Food and Agriculture.
Oh, okay. The question is on the Food and Nutrition Service. Are they the organization that does the school lunch program and the food stamp program?
That's right.
Do they have any, in order to promote maybe involving those programs in this movement, if you will call it that, I think some would call it that, is there any effort to maybe tie in some of those programs, particularly the food stamp program, since by and large, a lot of, you know, rural and urban poor get a lot of those benefits?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. There's a lot of interest in that. In the Child Nutrition Act that's not passed yet, there's funding to encourage farm to school. So we don't know. It's been authorized for the last 5 or 6 years, but has never been funded. That's one thing. Hunger-free communities and the school garden program are both in the Food and Nutrition Service, and those are efforts also at linking the programs to this kind of local food and food security movement. Also, there are feeding programs that are encouraging the use of local food. The regulations are being looked at to be flexible and to not deny use of local food, So I think I would say that the environment is such that they really are trying to encourage that. But it is another agency. I'm really not supposed to speak for it.
Thank you very much. I think at this point I'm going to get one question that was submitted online, and then we're going to continue on with the presentation in the interest of time. We should still have a few minutes to address the questions that are coming in online. So, again, those of you who are streaming the audio, keep those questions coming in. Those of you in the phone lines, I'm going to ask that you go back on mute, and I'm just going to read one more streaming audio question that's come in. And I believe this question was directed at you, Elizabeth. It's coming out of North Carolina, and they'd like to know how they can get more information regarding the CFP grant application, specifically the deadline. Elizabeth, any answer to that question at all?
She might have been calling in from a remote location. So you have her email address on the presentation.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, I think, again, we're going to remind everybody, that question that came in from North Carolina, again, as they mentioned, on slide 130, we do have Elizabeth's contact information. You're welcome to email her directly. I apologize we couldn't get a live answer for you. I'm going to continue things on with the presentation. I'm going to direct everybody to move on to slide number 131. We are still on time, so thank you all very much for bearing with us, and I thank the presenters for working to move through their materials swiftly. We are going to be joined by Angie Tagtow. Just a reminder, if you're on the phone lines, please place yourself back on mute. You can hit the *6 command to mute your line right now. Angie, are you ready to go, starting on slide 131?
Yes. Can you hear me, Jean?
You're coming through loud and clear. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks again for the invitation to be part of the panel presentation today. The hat that I'm wearing today, for the purposes of this presentation, is I am one of the co-conveners for the Iowa Food Systems Council. It's a reinvention of the Generation 1 of the Iowa Food Policy Council. I'm also a public health dietitian and an environmental nutrition consultant, connecting the dots between the health of our natural resources, the health of our food system, and, of course, public health. So I am going to peruse through several of the slides, and I'm going to change my approach a little bit and hopefully build upon the three previous presentations and maybe greater emphasize the role of policy. So moving on to slide 133.
Again,
this is a reminder. Please place your phone lines on mute. I can hear a side conversation. If the phone, again, you're going to want to hit *6 or use your own mute button.
Plus any initiative, not just publications, but activities.
Okay. Well, moving on to slide 133, Wendell Berry once wrote, "Eating is an agricultural act," and I think as we've already learned, we've become very disconnected and disengaged with where food comes from and the role specifically of agriculture has on the quality, quantity, and biodiversity of our food supply. And I think we have now realized that agriculture policy is really food policy, therefore it's health policy. So moving on, just to briefly talk about food systems, we already have seen several models of food systems. So looking at model 135, the pieces that I really want to emphasize is that our food system sectors are really built upon a host of inputs, whether they're natural, human, or economic inputs. And Ann started out talking about soil and water as natural resources, and I think we often forget that we need to have those healthy natural resources as the foundation for our food system sector. And, you know, we have these cadre of other influences on our food system as well, whether they're social values and trends, economics, education, research, technology, but it's really policy that dictates almost every aspect of these systems. Policy dictates what gets grown, what gets harvested, what gets processed, packaged, labeled, transported, stored, and ultimately available for us to purchase and consume. And it's really policy on a variety of levels that influence the system. So moving on, there's another model from the C.S. Mott Group for Sustainable Food Systems. And then we have this term sustainability. So moving on to slide 138, The definition that I often use is from Joan DiGusso and Kate Clancy, and they said that sustainability is the capacity of being maintained over the long term while meeting the needs of the present without jeopardizing the ability to meet future generation, the needs of future generations. And we have a variety of definitions out there for the term sustainability, and depending upon who is using them, it's actually been co-opted by the food industry and other entities as well. I turned to Dr. Frederick Kirschman at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, and I asked him several years ago, I said, Fred, you know, I really want a black and white, hard and fast definition of sustainability that can be used as the standard in these discussions. And he came back and he said, well, since nature is full of emergent properties, sustainability is always an emerging concept. It's about maintaining something indefinitely into the future. Consequently, to be sustainable, we have to anticipate and successfully adapt to the changes ahead. Sustainability is a process. It's not a prescription. And the process always requires the social, ecological, and economic dimensions. There is, therefore, no simple definition. It's a journey we embark on together, not a formula we agree to. So I think we've learned so far that with all of the examples that have been presented, and the same with sustainability, it really needs to be adapted and defined geographically. So what do we get, moving on to slide 141, when we put these two terms together? The definition, or not definition, but the series of characteristics, which Kim has already alluded to, Allison Harmon at Montana State University and I have come up with these characteristics of a sustainable and resilient food system. First and foremost, conserves and renews natural resources. It advances social justice and animal welfare. It builds community wealth, just what Ken was mentioning. But most importantly, it fulfills the food and nutrition needs of all eaters now and in the future. So my theory is that when food and the food system becomes a community asset, you know, and we see food production and processing and local consumption within a community, theoretically, this is going to be increasing access to more fresh, locally grown food. With that increase in access, we hope that it will improve food security, like Liz mentioned, both at the household and at the community level. And so when we have increased access, hopefully we have increased consumption of these fresh, whole foods, oftentimes fruits and vegetables. Thereby, I really believe that it would have a significant impact on the progression of diet-related chronic diseases that we're seeing today and ultimately impact the rates in our healthcare costs. So moving on to the picture of the strawberries, this is a question that has guided a lot of my work over the years, is how do we make healthful foods the easiest choices? And I contend that it's a way of leveraging policy at all of these different levels. We have two new tools that are available to us today that were not available a couple of months ago that helps us leverage these policies. The White House Task Force on Childhood Obesity just recently released a report in which more than half of their priority areas focus on creating healthy food environments. Likewise, the draft dietary guidelines that just came out, first time they have ever emphasized the needs for altering or improving environments that support healthy eating policies. So that puts us in a really good position to looking at our food system from a health standpoint and how we can leverage policies to do so. The good food concept originates from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, and it really, again, looks at these characteristics of what many of these communities or states are striving to do, creating a healthy food system, meaning that healthy food is the easiest choice. You know, food should not incur disease, and the rates of diet-related chronic disease in this country are staggering. And the estimate that the average age of children, or children born today, are going to have a shorter lifespan than their parents. But also a food system that strengthens the agricultural base through diversification and sustainability, and the conservation of our natural resources is key, and that wastes are minimal or they're recycled. The one thing that I don't think we totally have a grasp on is just the amount of dependency that our entire food system has on non-renewable energy, and specifically fossil fuels. And lastly, the good food system needs to be fair, meaning that it does not exploit anyone or anything. And, of course, accessible, meaning that everyone has the right to fresh, healthful foods. Moving on to slide 144, this is a series of bullet points that outline the public health benefits of a food system that we're addressing today. And I'd like to also turn your attention to one of the handouts that are in your resources. It's called A Good Food, A Vision for Good Food for Public Health, and it gives a little bit more rationale behind some of these bullet points. First and foremost, the public health benefits of a sustainable food system, it puts fresh, flavorful foods on our plates. And when food tastes good, we're more likely to eat it. And if we're more likely to eat fresh, whole foods, that's going to increase the diversity of foods on our plate. It's going to increase those beneficial nutrients and have that impact on diet-related chronic diseases such as obesity and diabetes. And most importantly, we need to be thinking about the health of children and the future of our communities, our region, and our country, and as well as boosting food security, linking fresh foods to, for example, nutrition assistance programs, whether it's WIC, school lunch, or SNAP, may actually improve the food security of many communities. Next slide. Looking at relationships and social capital, Ken addressed that here we have an example of not only boosting the health and economic vitality of a community, but to be able to put that face to that farmer or knowing who actually grew that food has a way of building social capital. Protecting animal welfare, it's a hot button right now as to how animals are treated that are part of our food system. Ken also already addressed food safety and contamination. From a public health perspective, when we have community-based food systems, local food systems, if there is any contamination in that food, there's a significant decrease in vulnerability, which allows that food contamination to be contained, unlike many of the foodborne outbreaks that we're seeing today. And, of course, improving economic viability and stability and boosting farm incomes. Next slide, slide 146. The preservation of natural resources and ecological issues surrounding food systems. Just a snapshot of what's happening here in Iowa. We dedicate 86% of our landscape in this state. 86% of our landscape in Iowa, 30 million acres, are dedicated to agriculture. 24 million of those acres are dedicated to two crops. Those crops sit on the ground for about 3 to 4 months, and then that ground remains bare for the remaining of the year. And so what we have found over the last century is that we have lost about 50% of our topsoil. Well, looking back at the models that we've used and the importance of our natural resources in our food system, when the soil is gone, we're no longer able to farm. And when our farms are gone, we don't have access to food. And when we have decreased access to food, that's when societies begin to decline. Slide 147. Franklin Roosevelt said that the nation that destroys its soil destroys itself. And so there is a clear connection between the health of soil, because it grows healthy food. We know, as a public health dietitian, healthy food nourishes healthy people. And we've also clearly demonstrated today that healthy people form healthy communities. So the main reason that I want to steer towards policy today around our food system is focusing on the events in Iowa over the last 10 years around the Food Policy Council. So moving on to 149, the original Food Policy Council, which came into existence through an executive order signed by then-Governor Tom Vilsack, provided a vehicle for networking and communication as well as examining the food system here in Iowa and making recommendations to the governor's office on strategies for improving the food system in Iowa, but most specifically looking on food access, food security issues, as well as local food production. Slide 150. So the administration of the first Food Policy Council was handled by Drake Agricultural Law Center, and the governor appointed 21 individuals to that council. And in addition, we had about 7 ex officio state agency advisors who represented many areas, including agriculture and economic development and public health and education. And then there were a series of subcommittees or task forces that were formed, one of which, the Food Security and Health Task Force, was really one of the most active, and with the help of Governor Vilsack, made some very instrumental changes in improving food and nutrition assistance programs in the state. We had several funding streams, including USDA risk management. Next slide. The lessons learned, I think, from that first generation is that because it was assumed under an executive order, this doesn't necessarily guarantee longevity. When Governor Vilsack left office in 2006, the current administration has been involved in these discussions, has been asked for support, but none has been received, and an executive order has not been reinstated. Being that members of the council are appointed by the governor, it somewhat limits the involvement of other key stakeholders across the state. And so in making recommendations just to the governor's office on policies to improve the food system in Iowa creates a little bit of a limited audience as well. Council members also came to the table with various understandings and definitions of not only their role, but of what food policy and food policy councils were all about. And I think there were some struggles with strategies for cultivating leadership, and an individual actually assumed the key leadership role of the council. So moving on to the Food Policy Council version 2.0, in 2008, after about a two-year hiatus, a core group of interested stakeholders got together to determine if it was worth attempting to reassemble the Food Policy Council. And so we met in 2008 and agreed that, yes, this was a very worthwhile initiative to attack. And we began an 18-month strategic planning process with stakeholders representing food sectors from across the state. To date, we've had 5 meetings, and our deliverables have been a vision, mission, and a series of core function and goal statements. We've also identified key assets. We've secured resources. And we have started looking at the best way of administering a food policy council and the different governance structures that we could consider. And on the next slide, just shows you the process that we've taken and where we're at based on the red circles there. And the next few slides actually go through the vision and goal statements that have been developed to date. And as you can see, we are tackling several domains of policy. We have food access, nutrition, and health. We have environment. On slide 157, we're attacking some key economic goals. And goal 8, we're looking at social justice issues and fair food and farming. Moving on to slide 159, one of the, I think, keys to assembling people and bringing people to the table the second time around is being able to tackle a project. And so the Iowa Food Systems Council is doing a comprehensive food system assessment and developing a report card type of a document that measures the health, economic, environmental, and social justice implications of Iowa's food system. And with that will provide a good basis for priorities for the Iowa Food System Council, but it's also going to be the blueprint for creating not only policy recommendations, but also looking at research and program recommendations for the state. And slide 160 is just a draft of what we are thinking of for a board of directors for the Iowa Food Systems Council. And the last slide, slide 161, is kind of a recap of some of the lessons that we have learned in the last 18 to 20 months of this work. We actually created a roadmap that helped define the process. It aided in our measurement of where we're at and where we've been, but also as a great communication tool to stakeholders that represented a variety of food system sectors. We were able to get a project funded that I think was a good vehicle for pulling people together. We consciously documented the events and the milestones that incurred. It not only aided in our accountability, but as stakeholders came and went, from the process, everyone at least knew what had happened and the direction that we were going to. And it also was very helpful with preparing grant applications and reports. The need for resources, whether it's in-kind, whether your partners are bringing resources to the table, it's key to have resources just for the convening, organizing, and facilitating. Having a strategic planning process, albeit rather cumbersome and perhaps rather slow, because we are using a very participatory process, we feel that it is really building that solid foundation to give the Food Policy Council some longevity. And by being able to show this momentum, we've been able to celebrate quite a few successes. And we hope come November it will be official that we will have a new nonprofit corporation in Iowa for the sole purpose of monitoring the health of Iowa's food system. And last slide are just two resources that I wanted to pull your attention to that I think are also on your resources page. For more information specifically on the connection between food systems and public health, the Journal of Hunger and Environmental Nutrition did a special issue on that topic, and all of those articles in that double issue are available for open access at the website there. So with that, I think I did it before 3 o'clock.
Yes, yes, you did. Excellent job. We have had a couple of questions that came in specifically directed at your presentation. I'm just going to switch over to the phone line participants. If anybody's on the phone and has a question, feel free to take yourself off of mute. You can unmute by hitting #6. Again, any questions from the online participants?
I don't have that. I just
Okay, in the meantime, I'm going to read off a question that came in from our streaming audio participants, and this first one comes in from Florida, and they were asking what alternative energy resources can be utilized in production other than fossil fuels?
Good question. We're seeing experiments with other biofuels on farm. We're also seeing in Iowa an extensive use of wind energy. I think there's been some experiments with water energy as well. So farmers today are being really innovative in their approaches to shifting from fossil fuels over to alternative energy sources.
Great. I'm going to read one more question that came in from the online group, and this is coming in from Ohio. And they ask, or they make a statement that they are working to incorporate urban gardens and agricultural projects into our current statewide brownfields program. Other than the removal of the environmental barriers, what would you say is the next largest expense for developing these properties? We are interested in participating in, the structural components of these projects, such as irrigation, topsoil, raising the beds, etc.
Well, I'm not sure I'm the best one to answer that question. I do know that USDA over the years has had grant money available for new and emerging farmers for some of these infrastructure things, and I know EQIP funds have been available recently for high tunnels and things like that. But I'll maybe open that question up to Liz and Ken if they know of other sources.
Well, there's really a whole bunch of experimentation going on, as you say, and I think that some of the networks that I'm aware of that would be the most vibrant would be things like the organic conferences around the country. The organic conference in the Midwest in La Crosse every February has 2,700 people a year, and there's also organic gatherings in Vermont, New England, and the southern states, and in California and Oregon. And there's a lot wealth of information that's been developed over 40, 50 years of how to build up soil, how to do that in an economic way, composting animal waste and green waste into compost. Some very cost-effective strategies that are sort of homegrown on a farm. So I think there's a lot of information like that to draw upon in the, mostly I find in the kind of the small-scale farming circles.
And I would also make the recommendation that there may be some other state organizations in Ohio that could assist with some of these things, whether it's a farmers union or in Iowa we have an organization called Practical Farmers of Iowa, We have an Iowa Network for Community Agriculture. We have Women, Food, and Agriculture. So there may be some host of other organizations within the region that could provide assistance.
This is Liz. I'm sorry I hit my speaker instead of mute last time when I was trying to answer the question. But the Ohio State University has some alternative agriculture, small farm, organic stuff going on that would be worth approaching as well.
And this is Kim. In addition to everything that the other speakers have mentioned, I would also recommend specifically for urban agriculture, looking internationally, urban agriculture has been going on for quite some time successfully in a lot of different cities across the globe. And there's one organization in particular that has a lot of really great information, and that's RUAF, R-U-A-F, Resource Centers on Urban Agriculture and Food Security. So I would recommend looking at that for tools and resources. But in terms of funding, there's also we're seeing that for urban agriculture at the local level, communities are really leveraging funding from economic development block grants, as well as other sources coming from different federal agencies. So obviously HUD, so as Liz mentioned, USDA and other sources, and even CDC now, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Thanks so much, everyone. I just wanted to address, we are just a little bit past the scheduled end time of 4 p.m. Eastern. We do have a number of questions that have been submitted online, and I know there are still a lot of people still on the phone lines. So what I'm going to do is plan to take another 3 minutes or so with the speakers, if everyone's okay with that, to go through and address the remaining questions, and we'll formally close things out at approximately 4:05 Eastern time. I appreciate everyone's patience to stay on the line with us. If you do need to take an immediate exit from the session, though, I would direct you to be sure to follow the links on the final slide, slide 163, which will point you to a number of the resources that today's presenters have put together, as well as the feedback form page that we do ask you submit and complete. If you're looking for a confirmation of your participation, you want to be sure to fill out that feedback form and check the box to get a copy of the confirmation email for your records. So, again, thank you for everybody for bearing with us, and we're going to spend another 2 or 3 minutes answering your questions. I'm going to read another question that came in from Indiana, and this one, I believe, is specifically targeted at Angie. They ask, who specifically initiated and convened the Food Policy Council 2.0?
The core group that assembled were representatives of the Iowa Department of Public Health, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, Iowa State University Extension, University of Northern Iowa, as well as Susan Roberts and myself, who are consultants within the food system arena. So we were the core group of people that had the discussion about, is this really going to be a viable effort, and how do we go about it? And I have to say, within a matter of 3 or 4 months, we were able to assemble our first stakeholder meeting, and we attracted well over 50 individuals from across the state. So that was our indication that, yes, there was interest and enthusiasm for pursuing this.
Thank you. Ken, I have a couple questions directed at a map that you showed during your presentation. The first question is asking in reference to slide 68, which where we're looking at farm country, and they want to know what county is showing in Florida.
In slide 69, that would be Sarasota, Florida. There's also the Northwest Florida around Pensacola.
Thank you. The next question they ask, can you show a colored map of counties in the U.S.? Which counties have shown the largest upturn in locally sourcing food? Where did you get the data to build the map?
Well, that's just very easy from the U.S. Census. It has data on direct sales of farmer to consumer that are reported every 5 years in the agricultural census, and I basically just took that data and download the data for all the counties in the country, and then produce the map from that.
Thank you. This is a question coming in from Indiana again, and they ask, what assistance can USDA provide for profit entrepreneurship efforts? So this is for profit, not a nonprofit.
This is Liz. The Small Business Innovation Research Program is one possibility. You have to be a small business to apply for it. That's SBIR. It exists in every agency that has a certain amount of external research, and you'd be surprised what the Department of Defense funds and also NIH. So the Small Business Innovation Research would be one program that would be important. In the community food projects, for-profit entities can be partners, but not eligible for the grant, direct grant award.
And Liz, I would add that this is Ken, that there's also money from the federal government for farmers, value-added producer grants for farmers who want to do something that's a profit purpose but really allows them to do some value-added processing on their farm.
Okay, I'm going to move on with just squeeze in a couple more questions from the online participants. This one's coming in from Pennsylvania. They ask, typically, how long does it take from the time of submittal of a proposal to award project money to the community? For example, if a nonprofit submits a proposal by the fall of 2010, will an award be made by spring 2011 planting season?
This is Liz. In my program, it takes a little bit longer than that. I'm moving towards hoping that that will happen, but we see awards happening more in June, July, August for a fall submission.
Okay, and a related question, again, this is the one that we asked while you were offline. Someone was asking how they can get more information about the CFP grant application, specifically deadlines.
The deadline for this year will, the release of the RFA will be in September, and 60 days later it will be due probably in November, a deadline before Thanksgiving. You can look at the old RFA. It won't be all that different this coming year, and it's still online on our website, www.nifa.usda.gov.
Okay, great. Just three more questions, and then we'll close things out. I'm going to start to go in order now. This one came in from Denver, Colorado. And, Kim, I believe this question was directed towards you. They ask, what do you recommend in terms of soil testing and to learn more about the bioavailability of contaminants to plants?
Well, I think Ann can answer that better than I can.
And I would say it depends on the site history, but I'm happy to talk to you offline and connect you to our EPA Region 8 resources.
And for those of you who needed all of the contact information for our instructors, myself and Carol, that's all listed on the seminar homepage. The next question coming in from Washington, D.C., they state that the Viroqua Business Center or Business Cluster, pardon me, is an example of a popular concept that a number of communities they work with are interested in. However, the hang-up is usually how to keep the doors open. In other words, ongoing operating funds in an industry where, as you showed, the cash flow and revenue are not great. How have Viroqua or the Poultry Business Center kept the lights on?
Oh, great questions. I think in Viroqua it's been a real challenge because taking on a big building, they bought the building quite cheap, inexpensively, but there's very real cost of maintaining it. They had to shut it down for the winter time, and then even shutting that down has cost $4,000. We were able to get a grant from the Wisconsin by Wisconsin grant campaign to help move forward. We're now applying for some money from the Economic Development Administration in the state and some federal money to really provide a major grant to move forward. That's a terrific problem because some local investors don't understand the potential or just do not want to be supportive, and it's a real scramble at this stage to make it move, to make it go. At the same time, the businesses themselves are expanding and moving forward all the same, and so there's a lot of momentum in the business community. In terms of the poultry operation, that's pretty much been bootstrapped, but it's also true, none of the steps that have been taken require a lot of money, some individuals have put up money to do that, but also the project itself is a project of what's called the Main Street project in the Twin Cities, which has raised some funds both for sort of creating some of the broader vision, for articulating the model, and getting some of the early facilities started. They've also had quite a few donations of land from local people who said, here's land I'm not using, you can use it, some investments from local neighbors as well.
Thank you. And one final question coming in from California. They thank you also, Ken, for the economic perspective on urban agriculture. They ask, what measures can you suggest to bridge business cultures between urban ag growers and retailers with the goal of production of products being produced and sold within the local community, essentially having the urban ag growers become a single entity responsible for growing, packaging, and distribution?
Well, I think there's an example in Detroit right now. Greening of Detroit has put together a cooperative distribution service that takes surplus food from community gardens, not even commercially oriented gardens, but just folks raising food for themselves that have extra product, can put it into a system that will aggregate that up and sell it to local restaurants and to markets and so on. So that those structures are starting to form. I think we're at the very early stages of understanding how to have those conversations. Again, there's some startup costs involved, and it's not necessarily an opportunity that a wealthy business person would seize on if they don't see a quick return. But I think that building those very local distribution channels really provides some possibility for survival when oil prices peak, or when oil peaks and prices go higher.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. That was the final online simulcast question I had submitted. In the interest of time, it looks like we're about 10 minutes over our scheduled end time. I'm going to formally close out the question period today and remind everyone that all of the contact information for the instructors as well as myself are listed on the seminar homepage. Again, you can follow the button at the top of today's slides to bring you back to the seminar homepage. You can also reply back to any one of the confirmation or registration emails that you receive from me if you have other comments or questions, and I'll be sure to pass them off to you before the instructors. I'm going to direct everyone back to the final slide of today's presentation. Again, this is slide number 163. You'll find two important links there. Those links are also available on the seminar homepage. And the first is the additional resources page, which is a collection of a number of different tip sheets, guidance documents, websites, and other materials that were related and referenced by the instructors throughout today's presentation. The second link on slide 163 is our feedback form. It is very short. We do ask that you each take a turn to fill that out and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation, again, you want to fill that form out and check a box. If you're sharing your location with multiple participants, each person, once you fill out the form, you'll be prompted. You can click a button and have the next person fill out the form. So you can have multiple people fill out the form individually to each get their own confirmation record. A final reminder, this session was recorded and will be archived as part of the CLUIN Training Internet Seminar Archive, which is available on the cluin.org training page. You'll see a link to our archive session. Within about 1 to 2 weeks, a complete recording of this session will be available to download as either a PowerPoint file, just the audio file, embedded audio in the PowerPoint file, or you can also subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and receive the latest archive seminars as soon as they're available. I want to thank our organizers from the EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization for putting together today's session, as well as our instructors that were participants from a variety of different organizations and offices here at the EPA and other groups. I want to thank all the participants who reserved time in their schedules to join us today, those who asked questions, as well as interacted with our instructors, and I hope that you found this a valuable usage of your time. I just want to, again, thank everybody for staying on the line a few minutes extra, and I just want to, again, remind you to feel free to browse the other upcoming training opportunities we have available on CLUIN at cluin.org/training, and I hope to hear you or see you on a future Internet seminar here on the Cleanup Information Network. Again, this will be the formal conclusion of today's session. Thank you all, and I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, all.